Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, talking today about, well, maybe spending a winter somewhere out in the wilderness. That could be quite a journey. It's described in the book by Peter Guy. It's called Wintering. It's a wilderness story in many ways. It spans 60 years. It's a love story. Generations worth of feuds. There's lots of secrets that are withheld for a long time and finally revealed. Maybe you've read Peter's other books. Maybe you have some questions about the characters and the structure. Maybe you have a story to share about visiting the North Shore of Lake Superior and Gunflint and the Gunflint Trail. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can send an email at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page, our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Peter Guy, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I tell you what, I'm down to the last 20 pages of your book, and I intend, I'm having lunch today to finish it off. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you so much. I love the last 20 pages of the book, to be perfectly honest with you. So I'm excited you still have them ahead of you.
Yeah, I'm in a way, I'm kind of glad I haven't finished. It's nice to have that to look forward to. Well, you're a Minnesota guy through and through, right?
That's true. Born and raised in Minneapolis, where I still live.
And what was it like growing up in Minnesota for you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's not so different, I think, than the way folks grow up over in Green Bay and in eastern Wisconsin there. I grew up in the city. I grew up on the north side of Minneapolis. So, I'm a city boy, I guess, though my heart often wanders up north and to the wilderness. But I had a pretty, I guess, normal childhood. I went to public schools. I went to the University of Minnesota. Maybe the only thing that's worth noting is that I was also a ski jumper. And so spent a lot of time traveling around the Midwest doing that, including several spots in Wisconsin.
Yeah, there's a nice ski jump right outside of Madison, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, as a matter of fact.
Well, how'd you get interested in writing novels?
Well, I was a high school student, not a particularly great high school student, I might be quick to add. And I had an English teacher when I was a junior in high school who really sort of challenged me and lit a fire under me to just do better and to try a little bit harder. And the consequence of that trying harder was that I learned that I loved to read. I mean, I had read books, of course, by the time I was a junior in high school, but I'm not one of those writers who, when he was 4 years old, was reading War and Peace. You know, I was outside playing in the snow. But I learned, just to love it and to love that transported feeling. And I thought, well, you know, if I get this feeling from reading a book, maybe that's something I'd like to do. And so I've been aspiring to this for, the last 30-odd years.
You want to just sort of outline the basic bones of your story?
Sure. So Wintering is a novel. It sort of has two storylines, and the main one of which, I guess, is a story that takes place in 1963 when a father and a son, a man named Harry and his son Gus, decide that they're going to go into what is now the Boundary Waters, but was then right on the cusp of becoming the Boundary Waters, for the winter, ostensibly for an adventure. But it turns out there are a few other reasons for their trekking into the woods, and those are revealed over the course of the novel, and they're revealed from Gus, the son, to a woman named Barrett Lavig, who is many things, but perhaps most importantly was Harry's lover late in life for many years. And so together they sort of hash out this story of what happened, a pretty serious episode in both characters' lives, and in the process reveal a few other things about the family history, about the history of this fictional town of Gunflint, and about a really what I think is a really warm and tender love story.
Yeah, it really is. As I read it, the form of your book reminded me a little bit of Paula Hawkins' book, The Girl on the Train, although the stories are completely different. But the back and forth, the way you chose to write it, it frankly, it took me a couple of chapters to sort of get onto it, and then I really enjoyed it.
Well, I think I must be the only person left on planet Earth who hasn't read the Paula Hawkins book, I regret to say. But I do think that, you know, one of the consequences, I guess, of writing a story that moves around the way that this story does, and I guess all my books do this in to one degree or another, sort of tell stories within stories and, you know, stories that happen many years apart but seem to reflect off of each other, is that you run the risk of, not necessarily alienating readers, but, you know, giving them pause. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, though.
No.
I mean, I think that the curious reader is going to be rewarded in a handsome way if they stick with it. And it's not, I mean, it's not like I'm asking folks to read The Sound and the Fury or something here. You know, it's a pretty accessible book, I like to think.
Oh, I agree with you, and I kind of felt the same way when I read the Hawkins book. And boy, well, once you get rolling with it, it's really hard to put down, for sure. I spent some time. I was in Gunflint. I spent some time winter camping, although not in Gunflint. But as I read your descriptions, I thought, oh, you certainly must have spent time doing that.
Well, there's a dirty little secret about this, and that for as much time as I've spent in the woods in Minnesota in winter, which is a considerable amount of time, I've not ever slept in a tent in winter in the woods in Minnesota. But one of the things that I'm fond of saying is that I lie for a living, and hopefully I'm a good enough liar that I pull the wool over a few people's eyes with respect to that. I don't know. I think that, you know, the fiction writer's job is to invent things, and I say sort of coyly that my job is to lie, but in a sense, that's true. I make things up, and I rely more on my imagination than I do on my own experience, and as a result of that, I go to places that I haven't been. I write from the point of view of women and from old men, you know, neither of which I am yet, although I'm getting closer and closer every day. I guess we all are. So I think that's the fiction writer's job. I mean, you know, certainly there are writers who write from their own experience, and they're terrific writers, and they have interesting enough lives to do that. My life isn't necessarily interesting enough to draw from.
Well, how did you come up with this idea for this novel?
You know, the truth is, Larry, that this is sort of the first idea I ever had for a story. I've been going to the Boundary Waters since I was 10 years old. My dad used to take me every summer, sometimes a couple of times a summer. And so it's an area that I've been familiar, even intimate with, since boyhood. And it made quite a first impression on me, both the experience itself and the anticipation of the experience. You know, I'd heard so much about it. I'd studied the maps. I was just incredibly excited to go for all sorts of reasons. And I remember having this sort of sense of fear, I guess because I knew that there would be bears, and I knew that we would be outside of range of a telephone in our car and all of those sorts of things. And I was really sort of addicted to that feeling. And as soon as I decided that I wanted to be a writer, which, as I mentioned earlier, was, you know, in high school, I started thinking about the ways that this place could be the backdrop for a story. I mean, it's such a remarkable wilderness. It's so remote.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful, and there are so many variables that you just can't account for. And all of those things, you know, to say nothing of the physical beauty of the landscape and the tempestuous nature of the seasons and the weather, that's a pretty rich backdrop for a story, and I knew that even as a kid. And so I've been thinking about a way to set a story there from the time I first decided that I wanted to set stories there. And I'm not sure why it took me this long to get to it, but I'm glad that it did, because I feel like these characters do a pretty good job of inhabiting that place, and certainly they're interesting to me.
Oh, they certainly are interesting to me as well, and I'm sure to your other readers. Why did you choose winter? I can see in retrospect, but when you were first thinking about this, why winter?
Yeah, I didn't, you know, going back to that, you know, those thoughts in high school, I definitely wasn't thinking that I'd set it in winter. And I'm not sure why this is true. I mean, I guess I love winter. I'm one of those guys who would rather have it be 10 degrees below zero than 90 degrees and humid any day. So there's that part of it. But winter, you know, all of those things that I mentioned about the Boundary Waters and the sort of, you know, the mystery of it and the danger of it and the excitement of it, those things are all just more amplified in winter. And, you know, so maybe that's part of the reason. I also, this is what I started to say earlier, I don't know why, but all of my books take place in winter, and I'm just not sure what that says about me, but I guess it just happens that way.
Well, you could certainly, as a reader and somebody who's canoed up there, I was certain that you had spent a lot of time around the Gunflint Trail area.
I have, and in fact, I've spent a lot of time there in the winter as well. I do a lot of hiking in the winter, a lot of skiing up there in the winter. So I am familiar with the woods in winter, and I do think that it's a magical place in winter. Of course, I think that it's magical all the time, but in winter, you know, there's just all the sort of sounds of nature and sights of nature aren't there. It's just the bare trees and the white snow. You know, it's black and white, really, and it's just the silence is more. There are even fewer people there in winter than there are in summer, which is saying something, because you can go days without seeing people in the Boundary Waters. And I just wanted that quality of isolation. And in fact, part of the story sort of relies on that isolation for it to work. And I suppose that's another of the reasons that I set it in winter.
Yeah, I would think so. And I'm with you. I really enjoy cross-country skiing, and I enjoy getting off into the woods, into the deep woods, because it is such a different life than when you're walking trails.
Yeah, it really
is. In summertime.
Yeah. One of the things that I love best about it in winter is just the complete absence of sound, which... I don't know how to describe it other than that. You know, there are no leaves to be rustling in the wind. The only sound, in fact, oftentimes is the wind, you know, is the sound of the whistling wind. And I love that. I love that silence. And I think that it's another good vehicle for storytelling.
Talking today with Peter Guy, he is a novelist from Minneapolis, Minnesota, the author of his latest book published by Knopf. It's called Wintering. Maybe you have visited the Gunflint or the Gunflint Trail or done some canoeing in that area. You may have some questions or comments for him about the book or about the area. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Malik Anderson, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network. Right now, having fun talking with Peter Guy about his latest book. It's called Wintering. It's published by Knopf, and it's a really fabulous novel. I've really enjoyed reading it, and I guess that the whole story about Harry and Gus. And going off into the wilderness is really riveting, Peter.
Well, I hope it is. I mean, that's the idea, right? One of the things that I wanted to accomplish when I set out writing this book was to tell a sort of old-fashioned adventure story in the vein of Jack London or someone like that. You know, a story where the heart race gets going a little bit, both for the characters and hopefully for the reader. So that was an interest of mine, and that's a little bit of a departure too. I mean, certainly my previous novels have an element of that, but I wanted to go even a little bit deeper in the adventure department.
Well, you certainly did. That last 25% of the book, there's some pretty high adventure there.
Yeah, yeah.
I can tell you that for sure. Well, tell us about Gunflint.
Well, Gunflint is a fictional town, sort of loosely based on the town of Grand Marais. So if you have listeners who are familiar with the North Shore, Grand Marais is, it's not the last town up the North Shore, but it's the last town of any considerable size. And it's a town, Gunflint is, that I modeled on Grand Marais, but I also... borrow from judiciously with in terms of natural features and the landscape and things like that. And I'm not sure why I ever decided originally to fictionalize the town. Grand Marais is a beautiful town and
it
certainly
is
worthy of its own place in novels. But I guess part of me feels like the North Shore is the North Shore. And the little towns, of course, are specific and beautiful and interesting in their own ways. But for me, I just think of it as the North Shore. And so fictionalizing it gives me a chance to do that, to borrow from all the towns and all the places along the shore. But also to, you know, to go back to what I was saying earlier, to lie about things and to use the town to suit my purposes for the storytelling. And I always put the story ahead of what really happens, you know, and I guess that's just sort of the fiction writer's job, in my estimation, is to use the story to tell the truth and not necessarily use the truth to tell the story.
Yeah, I liked how you characterized the town people, and I wondered about characters, some of those characters, whether or not any of them were based even loosely on somebody you knew.
Not necessarily. Certainly, you know, some of the minor features that characters have, some of the things that, you know, sort of tics that they have or things that they say, certainly I've picked those up along the way. But as with everything, I do my best to invent the people and to use them to tell the story. I think about this all the time, and I think that most people would presume that because I'm a middle-aged man who's spent a lot of time in the Boundary Waters and who's, done a lot of the things that Harry and Gus end up doing, that I would identify with them or that I would, you know, use myself as a model. And certainly some of my experiences in the Boundary Waters, I drew on those. I drew on them quite liberally, in fact. But I identify more with Barrett, with the old woman in the story, than I do, than either of the men.
And she's the narrator.
She's the narrator, yeah. She's an old woman in the book, an old, independent, sort of free-spirited and high-spirited woman who's lived a kind of a lonely and, in a lot of ways, sad life. And I don't mean to say at all that I've done that, but I understand her patience, and I understand her curiosity, and I understand her willingness to wait and to appreciate the things that she has in life better than I do understand Harry and his, you know, eagerness to set off on this crazy adventure. So in a lot of ways, I identify more with her and think of my, and I don't usually identify at all with characters, but I've definitely come to identify with her.
Well, she's a really, really interesting character. There's no doubt about that. I like Gus, too. I mean, there's things about him I don't like, I guess, in some ways, but...
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, I mean, certainly, you know, there will be as many different interpretations of these characters as there will be readers of the book, and that's one of the beautiful things about fiction is that, you know, it's sort of in order to complete itself, a story like this needs a reader. And so I'm all in favor of as many different readers as possible. But I agree with you that I think, I think part of the reason that Gus is the way that he is, I mean, I think Gus is a good man. I certainly wanted him to be a good man and a curious man and a man who's pretty busy grappling with some big things in his life that he has never really grappled with before. And I understand that if you're a person that's doing that, you might not be your best self the whole time. And it's not that he does bad things, but it's that he's reliving a fraught chapter of his life. And when you do that, you compromise yourself a little bit. I mean, I think we do that in real life, you know, when we're forced to confront something in our past or something that's happening to us now. You know, we're not necessarily our best self or our happiest self, and that's certainly true of Gus. And not that Barrett isn't suffering some of the same things. I mean, it doesn't
yeah.
spoil the story at all to say that at the outset of the book, Harry, who's also an old man at this time, has wandered off into the woods again. I mean, that's the
yeah.
first thing that we learn. So, and as I mentioned, she was his lover for many years, and so she's certainly dealing with some loss herself. But she's also got the perspective of about 30 years on Gus. And I think that those 30 years At least I'm hoping, oh my goodness, I'm hoping that they'll provide a little wisdom that I haven't yet found myself.
Well, I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question or comment or a story to share, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page, a Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. And let's take a call from David in Eastman. David, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. This is really interesting. My father and my brothers and I would go to the Boundary Waters, in the 70s. Every year we would go the first week of June to walleye fish and portage and this and that. And I remember there was this character, there was this woman that lived on an island. She must have been in her 70s or 80s. She lived there year-round, and she made her own root beer. And she would sell it to the canoers that would pass by her island. She was a fascinating old character. Have you ever heard of her?
I have heard of her. In fact, there are books about her. I think one of them might be called The Root Beer Lady, in fact. And I definitely knew of her. I think, if I'm not mistaken, she was the last person that ever lived year-round in the Boundary Waters proper. And I'm not sure how she was grandmothered in, maybe. But she was that person, and she's a legend. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And I could be mistaken. Maybe we bought a cup of root beer from her on a trip that I just don't remember. But I definitely knew about her. Yeah, that's a great character from a great real life character from this part of the world.
Yeah, thanks, David.
Sure, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Well, there's different places in your novel, and one that is really was scary to me was the Devil's Maw.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. That is a without going into the story, it's plays a in a way a kind of a central part of the story.
Yeah, and the Devil's Maw is it's not loosely based. It's based entirely on an actual place on the Brule River, not the Wisconsin Brule River, but the Minnesota Brule River, which is actually runs into Lake Superior about 15 miles north of Grand Marais. But there's an actual falls on the Brule River that's called the Devil's Kettle. And it's a fascinating geological feature of the area that I'll do my best to describe for listeners just quickly. The Brule River is a beautiful, winding river, as so many of them are up there. And about 2 miles up the river from the Lake Superior shore, there's a waterfall. And half of the water that comes over the falls just comes down a chute and continues its course. But the other half of the water falls into this cauldron, or kettle, as it's called geologically, and no one knows what happens to it. To this day, they haven't figured out absolutely where it drains or what happens to the water. I mean, the logical scientist thinks, of course, it must drain into Lake Superior underwater somewhere. But no one knows. And ever since I've known about that place, which is a long, long time, I've just been fascinated by the possibility of it and have been trying for years and years to write a story about it and finally found a use for it in this novel.
Wow. You do a wonderful job describing it, and it is a scary, scary place for sure.
it seems so unlikely to me that in this day and age, when we have sort of access to every single thing, it seems like from the planet Jupiter to the deepest trenches in the ocean, that there would be a place that we didn't know necessarily, you know, what happens to it. And that's fascinating enough unto itself. But to see it and to stand above it, and you can do that. You can make a half-hour hike up to the Devil's Kettle and stand at a lookout and look down on it. it's fascinating, you know, that place exists in this day and age. But it's one of those things. I mean, there are places like this in this part of the world, maybe because it's so remote and maybe because it's so untraveled. But, you know, there are features like that that just really are intriguing and really sort of mysterious. And the number of times that I've stood on that lookout and looked down at that and thought, that would be a place to go to disappear. Yeah. it is that if it's nothing else.
Well, let's turn to Jim in Toma next. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, hi. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just kind of hitting home. My best friend passed away about a year and a half ago, and he used to go up the Boundary Waters, and he did Blood Vein River up in Quantico and all those areas, and he actually made his own cedar strip canoes, and he made a big water kayak, and it's just beautiful. It's all handmade, you know, with the inlays, cedar, and I'm towing them home. His wife's moving, so I have custody of these until they sell. But as I'm looking back, I'm looking at a kayak that's just gorgeous, and it's blowing in the wind, of course, you know, it's breezy out here on the highway. And I'm just remembering all of Mark's stories from being up in Boundary Waters and being in Quantico. And I remember him talking about there was a Canadian, I guess you'd call him a Mountie or whatever, up near Boundary Waters, that when he was out there and stationed, that he had a little wood shop, and he would make paddles. And his paddles became pretty well known, and they're quite expensive now, and I think he's passed on, but Mark always would sneak over to the Canadian side and visit him and go back in the shop and just enjoy the camaraderie of, you know, a guy that builds canoes and a guy that loves building cattle. Just amazing.
Oh, thanks for that story. Peter, a comment?
Yeah, well, that's a terrific story. I'm certainly sorry to hear about your loss. That's of course, always a terrible thing. But I love the idea, and I hope I can say this, of you towing your friend's kayak back to where it belongs. You know, one of the things that the characters in the book do is they build their own canoes for this adventure. And the sort of, I've not done it myself, though someday I'm certainly planning on it, I guess when I have more time. I don't know when that will be. But I would love to build my own canoe or my own kayak like that. And as far as that story about the Mountie or the ranger there making his own paddles, that's a character that I'd not heard of. I'm going to have to look into that. But, yeah, I think so many of us have memories of time spent in that wilderness with our friends or with our brothers or fathers or mothers or sisters or whomever. You know, and for a lot of us, myself included, there's some of the times of our lives. And it's just the sort of place that does that, you know, for so many reasons. It takes a huge part of our brain to remember it. And to remember all of the times that we had there and the meaningfulness of those times, I think a lot of folks feel that way.
Yeah. Jim, yeah, thanks. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I was surprised when we were up there canoeing, the amount of hummingbirds that would come and visit us when we were in the camping sites.
Oh, you're right about that. There are tons of them up there, and they're little guys, and there's tons. You can weigh them all.
One of my favorite parts about spending time in the Boundary Waters is just, you know, is never sort of knowing what you're going to come across, you know, what critter is going to be around the next corner. And I feel like I've seen them all up there, including some hummingbirds. Yes, I definitely can recall that as well.
Yeah. Jim, thanks a lot for calling. And I guess, you know, this call to mind, he was talking about this Mountie who makes the paddles or has made the paddles. These are people who, as you, I think we're saying, that, you know, they'll fix things, you know, until long past many people would have thrown them away, or they're creative people as well in many ways.
Yeah. In a sense, a lot of these folks, you know, especially I'm thinking of the characters in my book, they're sort of forced to be, you know, it's not an easy place to make a living, the northern half of the state of Minnesota, and in any place really in rural America anymore. But there's not a lot of jobs. There aren't a lot of jobs. There aren't a lot of, you know, I mean, the they depend more and more these days on tourism and visitors and things of that nature. So the people who make it their year-round home and the people who have lived there for generations are forced to improvise. And certainly the characters in my book improvise, and they build their own gear, and they're, you know, no doubt the Duluth pack that they're using has been in use for many, many years. And I appreciate that quality of character, and I think that it's pretty prevalent up there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go to Rita in Eagle River next. Hi, Rita. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to tell our author that I just bought the book at our little independent bookstore here in Eagle River a week ago, and I'm looking forward to it. It's like just hearing it discussed, it's like I know I'm going to love it. I only purchase books that I intend to read multiple times. Otherwise, that's what the library's for, so I'm glad I purchased this one. But it's part of my winter survival strategy. Our winters here are long and brutal. My first winter here was 3 winters ago, the one that broke all the records. So I have learned since then that I need to plan for something enjoyable to get me through the winter. Now, having something set in Minnesota, which is also cold in the winter, and being an adventure, is going to make me feel warmer by comparison.
This is the first sort of comment I've had like that, but I'm just delighted to hear it. We had to talk a lot, I guess, my publisher and I, about the best time of year to come out with this novel, because it is, you know, most folks who live in Minnesota and Wisconsin and the upper Midwest, you know, we suffer our winters gladly, or not so gladly as the case sometimes is, but as a fact of life anyway. And I insisted that it not be a book that we put out in winter, I hope that it wouldn't be a book that we put out in winter because of how tired people become of winter. So hopefully for the listener in Eagle River there, they won't be too put off by the cold outside and the cold going on in the pages that they're reading.
Oh, Rita, thank you so much for calling. I love it. Jim in Lake City, Minnesota, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Larry. And I just have a question for your guest. We lived in North Minneapolis, probably around the time when he went, when he was going to school there, and I just would like to be curious about what school he went to and who his teacher was, because I think that's really important when a teacher inspires somebody to write or do something really important that they get acknowledged.
Yeah, my teacher was a man named Dave Benkin, and I've taken so much pleasure over the years in acknowledging the role that he's had in my life. He's a friend of mine. He's someone that I get together with once or twice a year and have a cup of coffee with, and we've just become friends, which is sort of strange, you know, having been his former student. Yes, I agree that he's been one of the most influential people in my life, and I'm just delighted that he remains in my life now. I grew up in North Minneapolis, but went to school at Minneapolis South High School, and that's the school where I met Dave and where Dave had such an impact on my life.
Ah, wonderful. Thanks, Jim.
Great. Thank you for answering the question.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Ken in Madison, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
Well, the ranger that builds the canoe paddles was Joe Meany. He was on the Quetico side. He loved to drink beer. He loved to make canoe paddles. He was a former canoe racer.
Oh, and do you know how his last name is spelled? Is it M-E-E-N-Y?
I think it's M-E-A-N-Y.
M-E-A-N-Y. Okay.
And he's got a brother that lives in Anacokan that has a canoe paddle building business called XYZ Canoe Paddles.
Oh,
I'm going to have to look into that. Thanks for the tip. That's fascinating.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling, Ken. Appreciate your call. Well, that's the nice thing about Wisconsin Public Radio listeners. If there's a question comes up, there's almost always somebody calls in with the answer. So that was wonderful.
Yeah.
You're going to be in, you mentioned Green Bay earlier, and you're going to be visiting the Reader's Loft in Green Bay on July 28th for a question and answer.
I am, yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. A couple callers ago, someone mentioned buying the book at an independent bookstore. And the Reader's Loft is one of the great ones. They're incredibly supportive. I think that they do work that's way more important than just selling books, these independent bookstores. They're sort of keeping American literature alive and well. And I owe just a tremendous thanks to them. So I am excited. And yeah, I'll be there. I'll also be at Fair Isle Books on Washington Island. I can't wait to get back up there. It's beautiful.
Cool.
Yeah. But what is that? It must be 2 weeks from today, I think. It's a Thursday, right?
Yeah.
2 weeks from today, I'll be in Green Bay. And I just can't wait. One of the pleasures of having a new book come out is getting to spend time visiting bookstores and talking with readers, and you know, and hearing from folks, and knowing that the book has found a home with certain readers, and that hopefully some of them will have enjoyed it, and I'm delighted to do it, to get out there and talk with readers, and especially delighted to get to Reader's Loft. Amy Mazzariello, who's the manager there, is one of the great champions of mine and a good friend, and I'm just really looking forward to seeing her.
Yeah, and you know, I'm thinking, gosh, this could be a good movie.
I agree. If you happen to have the direct line to Steven Spielberg, I'll gladly take the introduction. I don't know, Larry. I think that certainly certain books get made into terrific movies. There are examples of that all over the place. And in fact, my first book was optioned for film and is still in development, and it's a delightful thing. But for me, the way more important thing is what's happening on the page. I'm an author of novels, and I'll gladly have the books made into films, but if they're never made into films, that's okay too. Not what I've written here. So
that's not why you're writing them. Well, Peter, it's exactly. Such a pleasure to be able to talk with you today. And how's the book doing, by the way?
I think it's doing quite well. I'm pleased. My publisher is pleased, and I guess those are the two most important people.
Yeah.
It's one of those things. It's really hard to tell. It's early. The book just came out a month and a half ago. So, you know, hopefully it's got a nice long run in hardcover, and I know that they've already gone back to press to make more copies of it. So it's going really well, and I'm just delighted. You know, I never thought, a kid growing up in North Minneapolis, even once I decided to become a writer, that I would ever be doing something like this, talking with folks on the radio and promoting these novels. And I'm just delighted to do it and count my blessings with every question and every conversation. So there's no doubt of that.
Well, Peter, thank you again for being with us. And I hope we have a chance to talk again. When you get another book out, please let me know, will you?
You bet I will. And I really appreciate the chance to talk with you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Peter Guy, our guest. And by the way, his last name is, it's pronounced Guy, but it's spelled G-E-Y-E. Peter Guy. Peter, do you have a website?
It's peterguy.com, yep.
Peterguy.com. So, and remember to put in G-E-Y-E for Peter, for Guy. His book, published by Knopf, and the title is Wintering. And believe me, you don't have to have spent time in the Boundary Waters area to enjoy this book. There's quite a love story and quite a fascinating family story in the book as well. So I hope you'll have a chance to take a look at it. And we'll be hearing more and more, I think, from Peter Guy. Great talking with him. Well, here's some names for you. Steve Jobs, Sally Ride, Patrick Swayze, Pavarotti, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. What do they all have in common? Well, they were all diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And we'll be talking with two experts on this type of cancer coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.